Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Girl, real talk. This whole, it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash, is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So, yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
One of the things I really loved when I was talking to this woman, Abigail, who helped me to understand all that stuff about sizing, is she said this thing, bodies are unruly. And it's just, I kind of always loved that. Like, yeah, bodies are unruly. Like they're not gonna let us be interchangeable parts on a car. You know, that's not how it works.
I'm Jordan Kissner, author of the essay collection Thin Places, and this is Thresholds, a weekly series of conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterward. Hi, it's Jordan. I am overjoyed to be here with our first episode of 2023. This is a fun one because we are going to be talking about butts. My guest today is Heather Radke, who is a longtime friend, a Radiolab contributing editor, and the author of the popular new book, Butts, A Backstory, which is a cultural history of the female butt. She starts with evolutionary history, why we have butts in the first place, and then roams through centuries of social history and reporting, including the story of Sarah Bartman, who was forced in the 18th century to exhibit her rear end as part of a sideshow under the name the Hottentot Venus. The history of butt pads for drag queens, Sir Mix-a-Lot's song Baby Got Back, fit models, her mother's butt, her own butt, a lot more. Radke writes in the book, butts, as silly as they may often seem, are tremendously complex symbols, fraught with significance and nuance, laden with humor and sex, shame and history. Women's butts have been used as a means to create and reinforce racial hierarchies, as a barometer for the virtues of hard work, and as a measure of sexual desire and availability. Despite, or perhaps because of, the fact that there's little a person can do to dramatically change the way their butt looks without surgical intervention, the shape and size of a woman's butt has long been a perceived indicator of her very nature, her morality, her femininity, and even her humanity. Heather came on the show today to talk about, well, butts. Hope you enjoy.
It was actually a lot about how people would react to the idea. Actually just saying the word butts to people. It really elicited quite a reaction. And I just realized there was a lot of unconscious material there. And
How do people react? Like, do you remember? Is there a particular one you remember, or is it just a general?
I mean, there's like a bunch of, there's like kind of categories of reaction. And, you know, over the course of the years I've written this book, there's, I've seen, you know, I've sort of seen these things happen over and over again. So it's not like this is the first, like, it's not like I'm remembering the very first time I said, what sure. if I wrote a book about butts? But I mean, I think mostly people laugh because it's fun to say the word butts. We sort of don't let ourselves say it that much. So, or I mean, probably we do, but we don't say it in like serious moments, you know, like classrooms and that kind of thing. So there's like always a little giggle, and then there's like a few categories of reaction about the idea of a butts book. One is like there's this one time I told this writer who was like very, I don't know, he was like a real reporter, I'd say, and like was doing like important, like I think he was like reporting on like gems in South America or something big. And I remember him thinking it was almost like a cynical project. Like I had like picked this topic because I was going to like sell a gajillion copies or something. And I think there's that kind of reaction, which is like, oh, you're so savvy and kind of canny. I was like, I didn't really choose it for that reason. And then there's the kind of reaction that's like, people sort of just tell me their feelings about butts in the early days, maybe because I was doing the science reporting first, there was a lot of reactions that were like, and I talk about this in the book a little bit, like where people would kind of tell me their evolutionary psychology, biology theories of butts that they'd read in like Maxim magazine or whatever.
Oh, great. Perfect.
Yeah. But then sometimes, you know, I think I like, a lot of women will say things like, you know, they'll just tell me how they feel about their butts. Or they'll be like, I don't care about my butt at all. I'm like obsessed with my breasts. Like I always feel like they're too big, you know? So there's just like a kind of invitation maybe in the title and the topic to kind of have a feeling or have a reaction.
Yeah. I want to back us up. Oh God. Sorry.
No, I've like don't even notice anymore. It's like so unavoidable.
It's impossible not to accidentally.
It's okay to have, enjoy the puns, you know.
Thank
it's
you. Like, it's I'll do one my of best. The, it's one I'd of like the, to at least be in control of them, but it's. I think I'm.
You,
I think
you
we're
aren't.
Past that. Yeah, yes. We're past that. So let us back up to, I guess puberty, which is when I'm assuming, having read the book, you first began yourself to have a feeling or even just to notice butts and your butt and your mom's butt, as you write mm-hmm. in the book. Tell me about that. What was that like?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the way, you know, it's so hard to know, like, is this memory right? But I definitely like noticed my mom's body before puberty and like had a relationship with my own body, obviously before puberty. But I think like so many people, when I turned 12, 13, like seventh, eighth grade, my body started to change and I started to get a bigger butt. And it's so funny when I look at pictures of myself at that age, like, of course I'm sort of like, I don't even know what I was
what
talking about. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, and it just points to the ways that these kind of minute differences at that age kind of take on obviously so much import and meaning, and we notice them about ourselves and about other people. And there's a feeling that other people are noticing it about you too. So I started to feel like I had a big butt. And by high school, I sort of think that sort of became like an identity of sorts. You know, I think, you know, my mom, it was a part of her body she had often complained about, you know, in dressing rooms and just like in life. And I think it's a common thing to hear for young girls and maybe all gendered people to hear their moms talk about their bodies in those kind of casual, like, you know, that kind of way that we maybe it's tempting for all of us to talk about our bodies. Just like, oh, my butt's too big. Like my mom also used to always talk about how she thought her ankles were too fat, which is such a funny.
Aww.
I know. I think she has beautiful ankles, but somebody said something to her once and it really stuck with her. But so I think that there's these stories we have about our bodies, and I think in families and, you know, just in sort of casual moments, we communicate them to each other. So it was some idea I had that like a butt could be too big. And then I started to think my butt was too big. And then there's this moment in high school where there was like a little bit of gossip about how I had a big butt. And so I think this thing had...
Oh, no.
Yeah, I think this thing had that I had sort of like been lurking in my unconscious, like really sort of formed... Maybe this is the threshold, is like when I heard this piece of gossip about myself, like when I heard, or, you know, like this idea of myself as like having too big of a butt or sort of a gross butt formed when like this one girl told me that this other girl said that I remember it being something like, she was like, I'm getting a little bit fat, but at least I don't have a big butt like Heather's. it's mean. Of course it's mean. It's terrible. But I also just want to say, like, it's the kind of cruelty that I think, I mean, I can't even be sure I didn't say something like that at that age, you know?
Sure.
Like, yeah, I think we all participate in that to some extent.
Right. I am also, the reason why I gasped was less like, oh my God, what a moral outrage. But because I remembering being like a girl in the ninth grade, I can imagine how weird and vulnerable, like what a strange exposed feeling you must have had.
Totally.
Feeling like there were other people looking at your body and making judgments about it that maybe you weren't totally aware of at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, isn't that the feeling? It's like just like, the being seen feeling.
My butt's a thing?
Yeah.
Like, oh no, like, you know, so other people have opinions about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean,
I never had an opinion about it.
I know. I mean, and I actually think, I kind of wonder now if like, that's when I started to really have an opinion about it. Like if before that it was all kind of not fully articulated, but then all of a sudden it was just like, oh, this is something I need to like police and manage. And, you know, I'm being seen and judged and noticed. And at that age, and I think maybe always, that's just like a kind of... it's an overwhelming and sort of terrifying feeling, I think. And there's something about the butt. I remember talking to my therapist about this really early in the process of writing the book, where he kept like referencing, you know, that Coppertone ad where like the baby.
Oh yeah,
is
Jodie
like,
Foster.
Oh, is it Jodie Foster?
Yeah, that was like Jodie Foster when there was a TV ad.
What a life
ad.
She's had.
I know, Jodie. Man, I'm ready for that autobiography.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, she was the Coppertone baby when she was like 3 years old, oh, and it was God. A TV ad. That was, I don't know if this is true, but I vaguely remember hearing that it was like her first job.
Well, that actually just makes it all the more interesting. But it's like that kind of like the dog is like pulling down the underwear a little bit so you could see the tan line, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's this like kind of like, I think there's something about the butt actually itself that's like exposing, you know, that there's this kind of like, you can't see your own butt, so you are always dependent on other people to sort of tell you about it in some sense, or to look at it in a mirror, and that there's a real feeling of, yeah, exposure or like potential humiliation associated with the butt in general. And that in some ways, maybe that was part of the feeling I was interested in, is like that kind of like, you can't know it yourself, but you can. And you're sort of dependent on other people to tell you about it. And I guess that is a feeling that kind of came from that moment of gossip in whatever it was, the 9th, 10th grade.
Totally. I mean, I'm also thinking, listening to you talk about that experience, that it sounds like it was one of the first experiences that you had personally of the kind of the transition into being like a person with a female body in this society, which involves a lot of people making qualitative judgments about your body that somehow have personal, moral, ethical, political overtones. Like realize it's like I remember that about those years too, of how jarring it is to feel like your body signifies all of a sudden in a way that it doesn't when you're a kid.
Totally.
Or maybe in a way that's different than it did when you were a kid. But there are all of these ways in which we ask
I mean, bodies of all kinds, but I think there's a specific way that, you know, cis female bodies signify in this culture. And the butt is very much a part of that. And it sounds like that was your like crash landing into the experience of being looked at in the way that you would go on to keep being looked at as a woman.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things like, you know, that was 20 years or something, maybe not. Yeah, probably about 20 years before I started the project. And one of the things I think that got me interested in this as a book project was having conversations with my mom specifically, but also other people, other, you know, female identifying people about about that kind of moment for them. And also like the many different ways, the many different things a butt could mean, you know, like for me, that was a moment of somebody essentially saying, your big butt is gross. Like it's unruly and it's ugly. I mean, you know, she didn't say it like that, but that's the underlying implication, right? But my mom had a really different experience growing up with a curvy, big-butted body, which is like her family had told her that she needed to cover up her body when she was like 11 and 12 because it was like, you know, like the uncles might look a little too long, like that kind of vibe, which is like a really different, that's a really different vibe. It's like in her family and in her, you know, particular historical, you know, racial situational moment in like this Italian American, you know, Metro Detroit kind of 1960s moment, she was told her butt was like too sexual. And I was feeling like my butt was too fat basically and too gross. And like, you know, it's interesting that a body part can mean all those different, you know, that's just two of the many, many things it can mean, but you know, that it can mean so many different things. That also seemed really interesting to me as like a project of signifiers and kind of just like trying to make meaning of an object or a body part in this case. Honestly, from the very, very beginning, you know, the origins of this as a writing project were I wrote up that little anecdote about high school and like the thing about my mom's kind of different experience with her butt growing up and her family in a class in my MFA for Hilton Halls. And then that's when I started to be like, huh, this is kind of interesting how everybody in that class reacted to this idea of like talking about the butt. And then the next thing I did after that was I started to do some kind of like JSTOR style research. And I found this article from 1992, I think. The writer Lisa Jones interviewed the poet Elizabeth Alexander about Bo Derek braids. Do you remember this? Like where mm-hmm. like Bo Derek wore like, you know, box braids, and they were, you know, everybody started calling them Bo Derek braids. Of course, it's not right. It's like a major moment of white women culturally appropriating Black culture. And Elizabeth Alexander in this, who's, you know, an amazing, like one of my favorite writers, an amazing poet. And she has written a long poem about Sarah Bartman at that point. That's probably what she was most known for. And she was describing to Lisa Jones that she sort of mentioned this idea that the bustle, which is a 19th century fashion, was modeled off the body of Sarah Bartman. And I had known the story of Sarah Bartman, you know, since college, but I had never heard that particular kind of connection before. And I found it super fascinating as like an idea, and it felt like really resonant with some of the stuff that was happening in contemporary culture, like with Miley Cyrus and other white women appropriating Black women's butts specifically, or the stereotype of Black women's butts. And I found this connection to be super interesting and kind of profound. And you know, I had known about Sarah Bartman since college, and you know, for those who don't know, Sarah Bartman was a woman who was born in what is now Cape Town in the early 19th century. She was an indigenous African woman and was brought up to London in about 1810 by these two men who displayed her as part of a freak show in London because she had a big butt. And then there was a trial that happened to determine whether or not she was there of her own volition or if she was basically enslaved. And that's a very famous trial. But then the other part of her story that's really important is that she died in Paris and her body was dissected by this very famous French scientist named Georges Cuvier, who used the autopsy as supposed evidence of basically like white supremacy, so that white people were, you know, more human like than people of African descent. And also that autopsy report is really like a central document in creating and reifying the stereotype of like the highly sexual, big-butted Black woman. So that's like it's a big story in the book, and it's a very important story in any history of women's butts or butts really in general. So this article, it's like a very short article in the Village Voice from in the early 90s. Elizabeth Alexander just kind of mentions that there's long been this idea that the bustle was in some sense modeled off of Sarah Bartman's body. And I just thought that was a really interesting possibility. And I started to kind of imagine a reported piece about that. And I actually like pitched it a couple of places and they didn't get picked up as a piece, but I wanted to keep doing the research for it. Cause I worked in museums before I became a writer. And I was just also really interested in this idea of like what an object like the bustle can tell us that's maybe a little different than a text-based source. So I started to do that research. So you can sort of see how even from like the very beginning, that's like the first research I did for the book that would become the book. So like from the very beginning, I knew Sarah Bartman's story was always going to be there. And these connections, these kind of like moments of appropriation and the ways that the butt was used to create race essentially in the 19th century, that was always part of it.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
What did sort of uncovering the things you uncovered in the course of that research and reporting change about the way that you had been raised to think about your butt as a problem? Maybe not been raised. I don't want to imply that that was something that you were, you know, but no, the way that you had received culturally the notion that your big butt was a problem.
I mean, I think that's a good question. I think that the reporting about the 19th century racial science, I mean, that's what they called it. It's like a maybe sort of weird to call it that. But I think the thing that I kept seeing over and over again with the reporting on like the Cuvier autopsy report, the way that autopsy report like reverberates and like is redone throughout the 19th century, the way eugenicists use the story of Sarah Bartman and the idea of the big butt, all of that, it really made me think about not just the creation of Blackness, but the creation of whiteness and how much white femininity existed in the 19th century in kind of juxtaposition with Black femininity, and like that part of what was happening was that white women in the 19th century were situated as, you know, highly pure and you know, not sexual, like they're, you know, it's like virginal in some sense, and like the Black woman is being situated in this, you know, totally messed up pseudoscience as, you know, hypersexual. And they're using the butt to do that work in some ways. It's like this, the butt becomes like one of the symbols of that division. And there's even this like kind of interesting eugenicist report thing that's like where this guy goes and tries to prove that even white sex workers have big butts, that like the big butt is about sex and it's like sort of even transcends race. It's like this, the hypersexual woman is the big butted woman. And I guess, you know, thinking about, you know, that in some sense that that's why it was considered gross in that moment, you know, not by that particular, like, I don't want to throw this particular person like under the bus too much. It's like a cultural thing of like the small butt is the white butt, and it's the kind of butt that's under control, and it's the butt that's not too sexual, you know? And I think in the 20s, there's also this new association that gets kind of put onto thin bodies, which is also like this kind of chicness and coolness that comes from, you know, Coco Chanel and Paul Poiré, and an idea of the, like what they called the rectangle woman. And sometimes that, like, as this, you know, there's like a little bit of androgyny in it, and there's a kind of a certain amount of perceived, although maybe not actual, freedom in it. And that all of those associations are happening on the buttless body. And it's, and to some extent, it's no wonder that that was the body that I sort of craved to have. It's a, especially in the early 90s, it was really situated as a, as something desirable, but also something cool. And like, that was, you know, probably why I felt like that was the correct body to have. I mean, there was a lot, it was like basically 100 years of fashion telling me that that was the right body to have, plus, you know, several hundred more years of associations about race and hierarchy and, you know, what a controlled and kind of correct body looked like to went into that moment. I don't know if that answers your question, but.
I mean, it does, or at least it partially does, which is, I guess, what I'm hearing you say is that it felt like all of a sudden you had hundreds of years of context for the feeling that you had on the day that you were told that your butt was big when you were in the eighth or ninth grade. Did it change how you actually felt?
After I wrote the book, like, did I?
Yeah, like in your body. Did that research change how you felt in your body or about your body? There was 20 years between like the eighth grade and the beginning of writing the book. So presumably there had been some changes there too.
You know, I mean, I think by the time I wrote the book, I definitely had a more complicated understanding of my body and it being sexual and it being, you know, and like whatever, like, is it too big? Is it too sexy? Is it sexy enough? Is it, you know, more, you know, excitingly sexy? Like all those things were definitely like on the, like had, you know, I'd thought about them and experienced them in my body. But I think the question of like, does thinking about your body this much change how you feel about your body? It's like a question I'm very interested in, partially because I think like to some extent the answer is not really, which is a little bit disappointing. Like, I feel like it's like not the answer my publicist would want me to give you, you know?
But that's an interesting, like, that's fascinating, the idea that you can do so much thinking and research and writing and spend years of your life sort of thinking about the butt and feel maybe not that different about your butt.
I mean, it's like, I think the truth is I feel different. There's a lot, you know, but as you say, like a lot has happened over those same years. You know, I had a baby, there was a pandemic, which meant we all stayed in our houses and stopped kind of having as much of that experience of having our bodies seen and seeing other, you know, it's like we stopped as often, at least for me, I stopped feeling kind of watched in the way that like maybe I had as a cis woman in the world walking around for the previous 20 years. So I think a lot of other things were happening at the same time I was writing the book. And I guess some ways that my body, or the ways I thought about my body have changed is like, I think that there's a way that I've trained my mind to have more consciousness or questioning than I did before I wrote the book. Like, I notice feelings in my body, like about my body and about other bodies more. And then I sort of ask myself a set of questions about that. You know, it's like, if I'm like, oh, I look bad in this dress or in these pants or something, I'm like, well, why do I think that? Like, where is that coming from? Is there something I want to change about the clothes? Is, you know, is there something that's like maybe wrong with how these clothes were made for me? You know, but I mean, sometimes you can go kind of all the way down the wormhole and be like, what does fit even mean? What does it mean to look good? You know, like, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's like the worst thing to do with your time to do a little bit of that type of investigation. Because although it can help you make feel a little bit better about your own body, I think, and it definitely has helped me sort of change my relationship to clothes and fit. But I think it also can sort of help you to think harder about other people's bodies. You know, I think it can be, I think there's a way we can, you know, even in this moment where I think we try to be more respectful, you know, a certain kind of, maybe like a certain kind of person at least tries to be more respectful than we've ever been about questions of race and gender and to some extent class. I still think there's a way that we can be a little bit flip about not just like fatness and fat phobia, but just the way other people's bodies are and look, if that makes any sense. Like, I think we can give ourselves a little too much of a pass of like being judgmental in ways that are coming from our unconscious and our unconsidered moments. Like, maybe it's different, but when I got pregnant and my body started to change, you know, I think this book helped me to be really much more interested and thoughtful about that rather than really sad about that. I think a lot of women can feel sad or upset or something about their body changing. And there's this period of time when you're pregnant that's like before you have a big belly, but you're
bigger.
Yeah. It's like you sort of like thicken a little before you get visibly pregnant. And in a way, that I think was the hardest time for me, because it's like, there's something about a big pregnant belly that's like, I'm pregnant, like here it is, you know? But it just felt like gaining weight. And I think that was a time where I was like, okay, like, what would it matter? You know, okay, so like, maybe I'm gaining weight. Maybe it's because I'm pregnant, but maybe not. And like that, maybe that's okay. Why wouldn't that be okay? Like, let's, you know, that I maybe need to buy new pants. That's not such a big deal. I'll buy new pants, you know? I can afford a new pair of pants. You know what I mean? I don't know. This isn't very, maybe it's not very profound or very interesting, but I just think that there is this kind of, the thing that feels like it changed isn't that it's like I had some big epiphany and now I feel great about my body. It's more just like these subtle moments of like asking one more question or pushing myself a little bit harder to see bodies as like kind of an exciting multiplicity of humanity rather than problems to be solved or problems to be judged.
Responding to a thought or a feeling about your body or somebody else's with the question, well, where did I get that idea? Right? Like, where did I get the idea that it's bad to thicken?
Right. Yeah.
Or where did I, you know, I hear so many people, and you talk a little bit about this in your book when you're in the sort of the section on fit models and dressing rooms. I've heard so many people say, oh, you know, I have a problematic body, clothes never fit me. And I feel like something that I really love that you do in this book is say, well, where did we get that idea? And actually there's a really fascinating concrete history of business decisions, not to mention sort of cultural, political, aesthetic decisions that produce the person who feel like there's something wrong with them because genes don't fit them off exactly. the rack.
Yeah, and I think that's the most concrete moment, right? Because it's like there you really see how it's like, it's not, there's nothing wrong with you. There's something wrong with not just those genes, but like the category jeans or right. pants, you know? And
right.
And like maybe to some extent that feels known, like we kind of have some idea, like the beauty industry makes us feel bad about our bodies. But there was something for me that was pretty profound about finding out, like, it's like, no, this is how clothes are like designed to fit you or whatever, like how sizes are created essentially. And it's never going to work. Like nobody in the garment industry probably thinks it's going to work. And so like we right. shouldn't think it's going to work. It doesn't right. solve the problem. It doesn't mean like I can go and like now I've got like some magical pair of jeans that fit me. It just means I don't expect them to anymore.
Right, which is I think the power in asking that question and kind of chasing it down of like, well, where did I get that idea? Because sometimes, you know, we often experience those ideas like, oh, there's something, you know, my body is flawed because pants don't fit me off the rack. It feels like it's so kind of diaphanous and everywhere yeah. that you think it's just truth. But in fact, there are like very, very concrete there is a story. There's like a reported story that can explain exactly how that feeling was produced in you. In the same way that, you know, there is also a story, and it's the story largely that you're telling, or one of the stories you're telling in this book, there's a story of why that cross-country runner
yeah.
thought there is something wrong with a big butt.
Totally.
It's not a sort of like natural law. It's a thought and feeling that has been produced by people over time in pretty concrete ways.
Yeah. And I think a thing now that we're talking about it that I kept finding and I've took such delight in over and over again is just the ways that human bodies and honestly probably like animal bodies too resist our like weird human need to like categorize and order and manage. Like I think one of the things I really loved when I was talking to this woman, Abigail, who like helped me to understand all that stuff about sizing is like she said this thing, bodies are unruly. And it's just, I kind of always loved that. Like, yeah, bodies are unruly. Like they're not gonna let us be interchangeable parts on a car. You know, that's not how it works. Like all of our bodies are specific and strange, and like the desire to fit them into racial categories or into size categories, or you know, to manage them essentially, to sort of decide what they're, I don't know, to make them knowable in this very kind of industrial age way. It's like they won't let us. Our bodies just will not let us do that. And I think that can make us all feel very bad. And that's kind of where it's gone. But there's this other way you can go with it, which is like, isn't that kind of like fun and funny and amazing that our bodies do that for us? That they like let us be sort of specific and weird and different. And if we could like celebrate that and be excited about it, that would actually be kind of profound. And you see, I saw that with the science reporting. I saw that with the fit reporting. You know, when I talked to the Vinny and Alex, who are, they own this place called Planet Pepper and they do butt pads for drag queens. Like that's like just so much a part of their business model is just like the celebration of multiplicity. It feels like that's was a fun takeaway from the book that I kept getting to over and over again in the reporting.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking about when I was reading the book is whether or not there's a major argument to be made for like the deindustrialization of the way that we clothe and portray ourselves. Like one of the problems that you point out is the idea that we're supposed to make bodies, or we're supposed to sort of treat bodies like they can be clothed off of a production line, right? Mm-hmm. Or like they come off a production line.
Yeah, exactly.
And so many of the what seem like the positive examples or the examples of something that feel joyful, joyful interactions with the butt in your book are smaller operations, right? Or like are about like small scale, the small scale, the specific, the interest in metaphorically and literally kind of tailoring to bodies.
Yeah, that's nice. Like sort of like tailoring in all senses of the word. And yeah, maybe like sort of treating our bodies like special in that way that like if you get a garment tailored, it's because like you really want it to fit you and, you know, you're going to spend a little bit of extra money. I mean, I think one place I got to with the fit stuff was, you know, in like medieval Western Europe. And also, honestly, in a lot of other cultural garments, like a sari or something. These are garments, like, in medieval Western Europe that people wore, like you know, a tunic with a belt. Because that's, like, going to accommodate a lot of change over the course of a life. And garments are expensive. And, you know, you have to think, like, they weren't just, like, getting cloth. They were, like, growing the flax. And then, like, you know, it's, like, quite an operation to make a garment. And, you know, in some ways, I'm also like that, as opposed to like the highly tailored garment, it's also like the garment that can accommodate flexibility that, and I like each of those metaphors is appealing to me and a kind of like as a, like both like a concrete solution to this like industrial garment thing, but also like the thing that we're talking about, which is this kind of metaphorical question of like,
how do we make our butts fit?
Yeah. And like, how do we like allow and celebrate for like the vast diversity of the human form, you know?
Yeah. I think something that I was thinking a lot about when I was reading this book is the extent to which all of this received wisdom or you know, foolishness that we have about our bodies and our butts is communally produced, right? For better or for worse. And across so many different ways of sort of modes of knowledge production. There's science reporting in here, there's fashion industry, there's, you know, pseudoscience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you in this project have kind of taken on a very, very vast thing, right? The butt is universal in the human experience.
Yeah.
And it touches, as you sort of demonstrate, I mean, it touches or is touched by almost every aspect of sort of human society and working. How did you make the choices you made about the way, about how, what to eliminate functionally in this book?
I mean, it was like one of the problems of writing this book that I was like grappling with all the time is the feeling of vastness. And it's like, I love having you acknowledge that because sometimes, you know, one of the reactions to this book is like, how could you write a whole book about butts? And I'm like, the real question is like how I didn't write five, you know?
Right. Yeah.
and, you know, I think it was also just politically really important to me to be so upfront about the fact that this was like one version of the story of the butt, that it's told from like the perspective of a white woman who grew up in a very specific way, as we all do. And that, you know, it's this mind, it's my mind who made these sort of curatorial choices, but like in an exciting way, another like hopeful nod to multiplicity, like lots of other people could and should do this project and would do it really differently. It's what, you know, I had this big kind of long kind of conversation with the publisher about, I wanted it to be called A Backstory, not The Backstory, because I wanted to just sort of open up even on the cover, this idea of that there could be multiple stories of the butt. And then just as far as what I chose, I think, you know, I think like a thing I really believe is that like nonfiction writing is curation and following curiosities, and that's sort of what nonfiction voice ultimately is like making these choices. So there's one answer is like, I don't actually totally know. It was sort of just like, I followed my own mind. And like, I can see now how like my history as a curator made it meant that like, there's a lot of museums in this book. And there's a lot, like my history as a science reporter, like I was really interested in the science questions. There were some things that I had just always found delightful, like Buns of Steel. I knew I wanted to include just because it, like, honestly, I think that that chapter, I started researching it because I was like, that was funny. I remember it. I remember it being on like those infomercials as a kid. And like, what was that about? I actually just don't know. And then there were some things I felt like I had to include, like Kim Kardashian, which I was like really resistant to, but like obviously had to be in there. And kind of challenging myself in those sections to find something that did interest me and find something that I was excited about. And then there's just like a lot of stuff that got, you know, I started working on and just kind of couldn't do it all. And eventually like the book was due and I had to stop. So there was like partially because of my mom's history, I had done some research on Italian and Italian American butts and kind of like where this particular idea of like the big butted Italian woman came from. I had talked to a couple of like pornography researchers about pornography and butts. There was just like a handful of things that kind of were on the cutting room floor, but I think
your sequel.
Yeah, no thanks. but I think, you know, it's like how you make any reporting decisions. Like I was working on a number of things, and then the things that sort of had legs, so to speak, is, you know, when I sort of started to get traction. Like when I found out about the Norma Norman statues, which are these the kind of wild statues that a couple of eugenicists made to like show people who were what the most normal body would look like. Like that felt really rich. And I could kind of see how historically and in like a reportage kind of way, I could keep going on that. And and how it would contain some of the big questions I was trying to ask about the legacy of this racial pseudoscience in the 19th century, like how it goes into the 20th and 21st centuries. And just like how weird eugenicists were and how open they were about their project. I always think that's sort of an important thing to include if you can in any kind of reporting, because they were just so blatantly racist in a way that I think we can forget for some reason, and that everybody was eugenicist in the first half of the 20th century. Like the most surprising people were. It was such a big and pervasive project that we think kind of went away, but actually stuck around for a really long time. So yeah, I don't know. I think I just had a few things I was super interested in. And then like the topics that really would become clear that it was like a big, important thing that could contain a lot of ideas, then I would sort of keep going those. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. You dedicated this book to your mom.
Yeah.
How does she feel about it? How does she feel? I mean, I'm sure she loves it and is thrilled for you as your mom, but I'm curious if she had any reaction to the material that surprised you.
It didn't surprise me. She's been so supportive and so kind about it, and like happy to let me talk about her. But you know, it's one thing to talk about my own, but I do talk about hers in some of this press, as I have when I talk to you. I think she really liked that reporting about the dressing room stuff. And she told me, she was like, for a few months after I read the, because she read The Galley, you know, a while back, or no, she probably read a draft a while back. She was like, for a few months, I really did feel like better about my body, but it kind of has started to go away.
Oh no.
I know.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, I think maybe a difference between reading it as a book and reporting it is like, if you read it, you get it all at once. And maybe that there is a little bit more of a moment where you're like, oh, wow, yeah, like this thing about fit models and how sizing works is really messed up. Or like these racial ideas about butts is really, you know, that's really stark and intense. But I think, you know, I think it is just such an interesting and important question, and maybe something to think about more is like, can knowing a thing really change how you feel? Or is there something kind of like deeper that has to happen for the kind of change we're talking about, like changing how you feel about your body?
Thresholds is produced by Drew Broussard. Music and editing by Laura Faye Ashamud of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Lorelai Grossman. Special thanks to Justin Alvarez and our hosts at LitHub Radio. You can find out more about our show, listen to past episodes, and get in touch at our website, thisisthresholds.com. If you're listening to this on a podcast platform and you haven't already subscribed, please subscribe. Or you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you normally listen, and subscribe and review us there. Thanks. We'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.